Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and I'm flying solo today. My mother, Caroline, is not here, but she'll be back on the air with us next week. And as our frequent listeners know, she just turned 85 this month. And so we've been celebrating pretty much all month because although she is home alone, and I'm the only one who is able to go visit her because I'm being very, very cautious and not going out in public at all. She got about 100 birthday cards, so we're pretty happy about that. Today, isn't that great? Today we have with us Scott Spencer, the author of 12 novels, two of which were finalists for the National Book Award, including Endless Love, Waking the Dead, A Ship Made of Paper, and Willing. He has taught at Columbia University, the Iowa Writers' Workshop, which we'll certainly ask him about, Williams College, the University of Virginia, and at Eastern Correctional Facility as part of the Bard Prison Initiative. He lives in upstate New York, and his latest book is An Ocean Without a Shore, which was just published on June 16th. And we're in 2020, if you happen to be listening to a replay of this later. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Scott.
Thanks, Monica. It's great to hear your voice. My mother's 102. It's not a competition.
Well, that is really great. And is she nearby? Are you able to see her?
I'm not able to see her. I mean, I'm in New York, as you said, and she's in Chicago.
Ah.
And you know, I haven't seen her since the pandemic began, and she doesn't even want me to come there.
Of course. I know. I talked to someone recently who was, I hit a raccoon on the highway coming home from my mother's a couple weeks ago, and it did a whole bunch of damage to the underside of my car. I had to take it into a shop. Now, we live in a state, we're in Iowa, and there's a lot of people not wearing masks. A lot of people not being very cautious, and so I was a little concerned about having to go there, but the mechanic, the body shop guy, meets me outside, comes outside to the car wearing a mask, and I said, you know, I'm being really cautious because my mom, he goes, yeah, my parents are in Cedar Rapids and I can't go see them at all. They're not letting anyone in because they're of that vulnerable age group too. So wear a mask, protect your seniors.
Yeah. Well, my mother, you know, doesn't live in a facility. She lives on her own in an apartment. She's very strong and independent and, you know, basically undiminished by age.
Wow. Well, my mom lives alone in a house, and she's going pretty strong, too, you know.
That's amazing.
I know.
That's amazing. I know.
I know. So interesting, New York and Chicago, that's kind of the two settings of this book.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I threw in a little San Francisco and a little Amsterdam, but those are the two places I know the best, though.
Right. And one of your main characters grew up in Chicago.
Right.
And then both of them ended up in New York. And so how much of yourself is in this book?
Well, I don't want to give a typical answer. Oh, no, very little. but, you know, writing is very personal, and it comes from a very personal place in a writer. And I think that you're writing about yourself, even if you're not relaying the actual incidents of your life, but you're bringing your experience, you're bringing your ethics, you're bringing everything that there is about you to creating characters and creating situations. And so novels are probably a lot more autobiographical than any writer realizes. I mean, the things that happen in this book are, for the most part, either invented or are dramatic extensions of things that happened. So I do use myself, and I use what is that French phrase, esprit d'escoffier, which is the wit of the staircase, all the things I wished I said and wished I'd done.
Oh,
That
yes.
goes in there, but this stuff has to come from somewhere, and I don't get it from doing research and extensive going through libraries and journals and historical documents. So, I mean, this is kind of a long, and maybe it's a roundabout answer. I'd say it's about 30% autobiographical.
Now, An Ocean Without a Shore is essentially a love story,
Yes.
and you have been called the contemporary American master of the love story.
Yeah. I don't know
So,
what that means.
so what draws you to writing about love?
I've always been interested in the romantic and passionate attachments between people. I was even interested as a little kid. I mean, other kids were reading superhero comics. I actually read love comics, and I've always been drawn to that and drawn to this sense of that there's something that can take you out of yourself, that can bind you to another person, that can, I didn't put this in these terms when I was a kid, but that could destroy or at least diminish your ego. So as an experience, I have found romantic attachment to be really fascinating and invigorating. And as a writer, it's something that I enjoy writing about, and I'm not really sure why. I mean, there's a lot of things that I could enjoy reading about. I mean, I could enjoy reading about, a pitched battle between two opposing armies, but I just wouldn't know how to write about it. There's things that we can appreciate as a reader that don't really translate to our life as a writer. And I think part of the journey of a writer is finding out what it is that stimulates the writing nerve. And for me, what we'll just put under in the big basket of love has always been a stimulating thing for me to write about. I mean, of course, it opens you up to wild misinterpretation. I mean, because my books really aren't romantic in that, typical way. I mean, the most successful book I've ever written, Endless Love, and people say, well, it's just a love story, but it's really, much, much darker than that. And, I'm not writing love stories that would, make you want to trade places with the characters.
Well, that's for sure in this one. So, in
Yeah.
Ocean Without a Shore, we have Kip, who's been obsessed with Thaddeus since college, and Thaddeus is a charming, people-pleasing writer who, in turn, loves only two things: his wife Grace and their home. And both of those are crumbling, and Thaddeus figures out a way to bring Kip down with him.
Yeah. Well, the challenge of this book for me was writing from Kip's point of view, because I'd already written about Thaddeus in a book that came before this called The River Under the Road. And I wanted to continue living with these characters, but I wanted to do it from a different perspective. And Kip was in that previous book as a fairly minor character, but someone who Thaddeus had gone to school with and who remained in Thaddeus's life and it also helped Thaddeus here and there. I said, so let's let Kip tell this story. My original intention was to make Kip a kind of just blocking his name, the narrator of The Great Gatsby.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Help somebody.
is it Nick, or is that the other guy?
No, yes, it's the other guy. It's, yeah.
Oh, well.
I'm not going to Google that, but I'm going to make my mind figure this out. And just, you know, have him tell the story, but have it be, to have it primarily be about Thaddeus. But once Kip started telling the story and I started writing in his voice, he changed my mind about what I wanted the book to be, and it became his story. And I felt, you know, I went a little cautious in the very beginning because I was writing from the point of view of a gay man, and I don't identify as gay, and people don't think of me as a gay writer, and we're living in a time when everyone's supposed to stay in their own lane, and there's living in a time when there's a lot of talk about appropriating other people's stories, especially people who've been oppressed. But I didn't really have a choice because I had started off on this journey and I was into it, and I thought I could do it. But every book has its own challenge, its own thing that you have to solve.
Well, I have to admit that I assumed that you were gay from reading. You know, this was I have not read your previous books, although I would now really am interested in doing so. So to me it rang very true, but of course not having that experience myself, I don't know how true it would be. But it seemed like it was. Did you run this by? Do you have friends that you could like check it out? Am I being authentic here?
I you know, of course, like most civilized people, I have plenty of gay friends, but I didn't vet it with them because I don't know. I just didn't. I didn't want to. I wanted to trust myself. You know, subsequent to that, people who are gay have read it and have really been complimentary about it. So I guess it's a feeling of relief. But I didn't really doubt that I could do that because, I mean, we're all pretty similar. And, you know, the historical experience of a heteronormal man is very different than the historical experience of a gay man. But what we are deep inside is, I feel, is not that different. What brings us pleasure, what brings us pain, it's called human nature, and that's what novels are about. I mean, that's why I think, you know, the novel, while it may not have the paramount position in culture that it had, let's say, like in the 19th or early 20th century, it's never going to disappear because the novel is how we examine what it means to be a human being, and I think that we remain as curious about that and as uncertain about that as we were 100 or 200 years ago.
Well, to me, what was kind of more central to Kip's character than the fact that he's gay is that he was in the closet and how much that impacted him.
Right.
Now, this right. book is set in the late 1990s, early 2000s, and so perhaps it was more common then. Do you think there are still people? I mean, I know there are, but how common do you think it is now to have to live with that secret?
I think it's less and less common, you know, with every generation, and probably with every year. I think a lot of it depends on what your family of origin is like. I think a lot of it depends on where you're raised. I mean, I heard Fran Lebowitz once said that the toughest people she's ever known in her life were gay men from small towns.
Yep.
You know, is that as necessary? Is that armor as necessary now as it was 20 years ago? Thank God, no. Is it still somewhat necessary? Yeah, of course it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's still, you know, millions and millions of people in our own country who think it's an aberration. And if you're related to one of them, or, you know, feel that you want to please one of them, or if you're a Mormon, let's say, there's all kinds of circumstances that will prevent you from being open about, you know, what your feelings are.
Right. It's just hard to imagine having to live that way. I just
it's heartbreaking. It's your one and only life. It's your one and only life, and you don't get to be yourself. It's a total robbery.
Yeah.
But you know, but even in the time frame of this novel, Kip was unheroic. But I think at one point someone says, maybe it's him, they said, well, you know, if everybody was heroic, we wouldn't even have a word for it.
That's true. That's true. One of the things, Scott, that has been said about your writing is about how you use the English language. It's like, I'm quoting from the Wall Street Journal, I think. There are few novelists alive who use the English language as Scott Spencer does. Every ache of feeling, every failed effort at restraint, every attempt at self-deception is captured in precise, beautifully cadenced prose. It's probably hard for you to listen to that. me to say that.
Not really.
Not really, okay.
I think we should say it again. I don't know.
But I did, as I was reading, I was struck by that. Even before I had read that quote, I was struck by how you use language and kind of allusions to, I don't know how to say this. I'll give you an example. So on page 80, Kip is saying, please take everything I say about her with a grain of salt, which Pliny counsels will protect you from certain mild poisons. And just that reference to, and I probably didn't even pronounce the name of.
I think that's right. That's how I would.
Okay, okay. And just that reference to that quote, and in the middle of this, really struck me, and it's like, oh, take it with a grain of salt to protect you from poison.
Well, good. I'm glad you liked that. That's nice. Hey, guess what?
What?
Nick Carraway. It finally came.
Okay. All right.
My little messenger came from the back of my brain to the front of my brain.
So it was Nick.
Yeah.
So right. I was half right. Okay.
You were half right.
I was half
right. You were half right. I was all wrong.
And
well, I'm glad you liked that grain of salt thing.
Yeah, and then another one where you bring in Dante. You know, did Dante ever mention this, Your Honor? Here is what unrequited love feels like. No matter how many times you strain to swallow, your mouth is always full. Now, that one really hit me because I used to have, during a time in my life where I was not all that happy, I'd say. I used to have these recurring nightmares about having a mouthful of chewing gum that no matter how hard I tried to spit it out, the wad just kept getting bigger.
Oh my God.
And it had no flavor.
Oh my God.
And so I do not chew gum to this day.
I'm never going to chew gum again. I'm gonna go back to smoking now after that. No, that sounds really awful.
Yeah, it was. But that's when I read this line, it's like, oh, I know what he's talking about.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, Dante really nailed it, because that's truly nightmarish. And that's such, what I love about that is that it kind of pairs something cosmic with something that everybody has experienced. I mean, it's so easy to imagine.
Yeah.
Having your mouth full like that and never being able to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Terrifying image.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Scott Spencer, author of An Ocean Without a Shore. Scott, why don't you read a little bit from the book today?
Oh, thanks. I'd love to do that.
Great.
I'm going to open this up here. This is the narrator, Kip, who, as you know, Monica's already said, is a closeted gay man. And he works for an investment company, and now and again he manages to get to Detroit, where he was raised, and he is going to, he likes to go and visit his family. Because of this appointment, it's late. His sisters have already gone back to their houses, and his mother is not doing well health-wise, is upstairs, and he's at the kitchen table with his father, who is a makes custom-made shirts. And, you know, as we said, he's never discussed his sexuality with his father. But his father seems like he wants to talk about it. And he starts off, he says, there's a lot of regret, Kip. I knew this was where we were headed. I could sense it, the way you can smell the nearness of rain. We were about to revisit the conversation in which he blurted out how repulsive it was to measure the necks and limp wrists of the various fairies who came to him for customized shirts. As much as it had wounded me then, I'd also taken a kind of comfort in the outburst, figuring that my father, who loved me, who was gentle and kind, would not make odious remarks about the men he measured if he suspected for a moment I might take them personally. Yet even then, rendered half stupid by my need to believe in my father's love, a smaller yet persuasive part of myself suspected that Dad sensed in me a vulnerability to a so-called lifestyle that was abhorrent, disgusting, and disqualifying, a subculture of the contemptible who he imagined were making up for their inability to multiply in the normal way by luring unsuspecting suckers into their doomed community. I remember you were extremely accommodating when it came to my weirdness about what I could eat and what made me sick, I said. You knew this pizza place where they put hardly any tomato sauce on it, just brushed it on like a pink wash in a watercolor. Oh, yeah, he said. Taste of Capri. I knew the owner quite well. Poor guy, just passed. Well, not really all that poor, actually. He took the franchise route and made important money. There were 7 tastes of Capri in Michigan alone. Good old Andy Manzardo. I can't tell you how good it makes me feel that you remember those pizzas. Well, all right then. He never married, my father said. Everyone used to pester Andy about it. I guess that was pretty stupid. What did we know, right? It was a long time ago. I don't mind tomato sauce anymore, I said. I actually like it, done right. The thing about marriage is, "It's not for everyone," my father said, "and that's okay. It's a big world, and there's room for everyone." He looked relieved, unburdened. This is what he'd wanted to say. He was as close to speaking the truth as he dared to venture, not to actually speak the truth, but to scale a little promontory from which the dim outlines of the truth could be seen, that great gated city in the mist. I made a lot of shirts for that man. My clients are the cream of the crop, men who don't hesitate to pay 3 or 4 times the store price for the right shirt. The funny thing is, when I'm seeing customers, I make sure to wear a custom shirt. But other than that, I buy most of my shirts right out of Macy's. He squinted at me, took in what I was wearing, and nodded approvingly. Very nice, by the way. Well, I got it at Bergdorf Goodman. Oof, he said, rubbing his thumb and 2 fingers together. Or maybe Macy's. Well, somehow I doubt it. My son is a rich man, a very wealthy man indeed. He said I was about to object, but he stopped me with a raised hand, which comes as no surprise. I always knew you were going to be special, and a smart cookie, too. Make no mistake about it, smarter than your old man, that's for sure. I don't see you getting tied down to any one person. Hey! He slammed both his hands onto the table, and the sudden noise made me almost yelp. He was closing the door to the room in which his innermost unhappiness lurked. But I had gotten a glimpse of it. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make you 3 shirts. You don't have to. No, 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 no. I want to. It's an honor. And you know what? It's good business. The people you mix with, the hoi polloi, they see you in one of my custom shirts and they say, "Hey, where'd you get that shirt?" And some of them could end up right here, getting measured for shirts of their own, right? He struggled out of his chair. To my great regret, the head of his penis came through the pajama flap, like the head of an anxious actor parting the curtain to see if the house was full. "Wait right here," he said. "Where are you going?" "Upstairs. I'll bring down the sample books to do the measurements, and then we're off to the races." 15 minutes passed, and I decided what had happened. I was sure of it. Was he had stretched out next to Mom and accidentally fallen asleep. I waited a few more minutes just to be sure, finished my drink, took my notebook out of my jacket's inside pocket, and tore out a piece of paper and wrote him a note. "See you in the morning. Great talking with you. Much love. By the way, hoi polloi doesn't mean fancy people. It actually means just the opposite." I slipped the note under the sugar bowl and sat there for an extra moment or two, just enough time to come to my senses. I grabbed the note and ripped it in half and in half again. I didn't even want to put it in the garbage, though nothing I'd ever touched deserved more to be put into the garbage. I shoved it in my pocket, turned off the kitchen light, and climbed the silent stairs to my boyhood bed, thinking to myself, in a sense, all of us continue to sleep in our childhood beds.
And that was Scott Spencer reading from An Ocean Without a Shore. And in a, you know, that really does tell us a lot about Kip in that scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. So, Scott, you've written 12 novels, or you've published 12 novels. Have you? Or do you have some that are unpublished?
Yes, I have one that I never let out of my house.
Most of the authors I talk to have at least one
attic.
Of those. Was it your first one?
No, it was my third one. It was my third one. It was called... Or it is called The Favorite.
But it is not.
I, of course, have affection for it. I understand. I mean, I understand what's wrong with it and could not figure out a way to fix it. But I still fantasize finding it and, you know, having all this moment, oh my God, this was great. How did I didn't know? But it was probably, you know, dead on arrival.
Oh, are you absolutely sure about that?
No. Not absolutely sure, but
wow.
I think what I was doing in that book is trying to, it was sort of a British in tone. It was very, well, it's not even fair to British writing because it's not even like that. It was sort of 1950s in tone. It was very muffled and, you know, way, way, way too indirect. And
Okay. I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you become a novelist?
I became a novelist because, you know, like most novelists, I liked reading. I mean, when I hear some novelists talk about their reading lives as children, I think, wow, they really read a lot. But I didn't read in good weather because I really liked sports too. But I read an awful lot and I enjoyed writing, and I was not really super successful in school. But my teachers and my parents always were really very encouraging about writing. So I just really kept on putting my chips on that square, because that's what seemed to be working. And then when I got older, let's say to college age, I became really pretty serious about literature, and it had deep meaning for me, and it unlocked something in me, some scope of feeling and of contemplation and awareness that was, you know, almost like a religious revelation. It was just encompassing, and I just wanted to be a part of that world, and, you know, I wanted to add my voice to that, and I did. I mean, to, you know, I had never met a published writer. I mean, one of my parents' friends had a letter to the editor of the Chicago Tribune printed, and they were kind of a celebrity from it. But, you know, my parents, you know, were working class, but they were also intellectual. They were very, very political, very left, and these were the values and the things that that concerned them. I was actually just telling this story last night that, and this is what happens when you get your information from. Only from reading and not from conversation. I was, because I was an only child, my parents took me with them, you know, when they would socialize, and I was at a party. I was like 12 years old, maybe 11 or 12, and I was talking to a couple of their friends, and I described somebody as a pseudo intellectual. And this woman's eyes just lit up with such delight. And she called her husband over and asked me to say it again. I realized I'd made a horrible mistake.
Oh. Well, that's kind of mean of her.
it just thrilled her. It was about the funniest thing she'd heard all night.
Oh.
Yeah, it wasn't too nice.
No, no.
Wow. Yeah, but that's what I wanted to be, you know.
So when did you write the first one? Were you still in college when you were writing your first novel?
Well, still in college, yes, but that's a misleading phrase because it took me a long time to get through college.
Oh, don't
I
feel
mean,
bad. I'm not done yet.
oh, good. Well, but I was 24, and I wrote a book called Last Night at the Brain Thieves Ball, and it was
Wait, last night out the what ball?
at last night at the Brain Thieves Ball.
The Brain Thieves
Don't,
Ball. Okay.
yeah, I mean, it's ununderstandable. And my model for it was this somewhat early Nabokov novel called Despair, in which you slowly realize that the events being narrated to you are being told to you by somebody who's pretty crazy, and you actually start making your own sense of what happened. And in Last Night at the Brain Thieves Ball, I took my undergraduate understanding of experimental psychology and how the brain functions, and sort of married that to a kind of science fiction plot that was essentially comedic. And so, I mean,
Okay, this
I don't really,
sounds
so
intriguing.
I don't really read the science fiction. So doing a parody of it was probably a little premature, but it was, I thought, quite funny. I thought it was, in fact, to me, it was really funny. And I found a literary agent in New York through a friend of a friend, and the world of publishing was so different then that this agent submitted it to well over 20 different publishing houses. I mean, and there were mainstream ones. They were not they weren't independent. They were corporate New York publishing houses, and ultimately, or finally, sold it to Houghton Mifflin. And
Which is pretty impressive for a
which is
first-time
very
novelist.
impressive for a first-time novel, and it's also impressive that it's the 25th place that she went. And when I went to see my editor at Houghton Mifflin, who was very imposing and elegant Upper East Side woman who was married to a heart surgeon, she said, "This book is terrifying. I mean, this stuff could happen. This is really, really frightening." And
So
I
she
was,
didn't read it as comedy.
she didn't read it. What she didn't think there was one funny thing in it. And I learned a lesson there because I was so excited and frankly grateful that someone was going to publish this book that I didn't want to say anything that would upset the apple cart. So I went, yeah, it's pretty frightening, pretty frightening. And that's how they published. And the lesson that I learned is that at a certain point, you have to make sure that you and your publisher really feel the same way about the book, because how the publisher publishes it will affect the book, and sometimes affect it a great deal. And not only just in terms of, you want a publisher who's enthusiastic and who believes in you and thinks that what you're doing has value and even maybe some importance, but also just reads the text in a way that you intended.
So did any, after the book came out, were there any reviews that were like, this book is hysterical?
The
Or
first book that the first one that came out was said, This is the most frightening book since George Orwell's 1984.
And that set the tone.
I went, oh my God. I mean, I just kept my head down.
Wow.
I mean, the book didn't exactly make a splash. And the Times had a short review of it that did think it was funny.
Mm.
Or,
well, it sounds like you had really had early success. You know,
well,
maybe not what you were expecting,
but to
get published by a major house, get reviewed in the New York Times, that's not a lot of people can say that at age 24.
No, well, by the time it happened, I was 27.
Oh, well, then, no big deal.
I was old. I was on life support.
So,
no, it didn't, you know, the thing about that is that, you know, when you're 27, you're very young, but you don't know that. So it didn't really feel like early success. I mean, I was thinking, you know, Rimbaud's career was done by this time.
Oh, wow. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Scott Spencer, author of An Ocean Without a Shore. Scott, let's talk a little bit about the Iowa Writers' Workshop.
Ah.
When were you
there? Yes, I
taught
there twice.
You taught there twice,
Yes. I taught there once during the reign of Frank Conroy, and then more recently during when Sam Chang began to run it.
And did you come just like for a year each time?
I came for a semester each time.
A semester. And so tell us a little bit about your experience of being in Iowa City and being in that very famous, you know, teaching in that very famous program.
Well, you know, of course it's you feel the history of the place when you're there. And you also, you know, realize that the students that you're working with have gone through a lot to get there, and you also realize that they're paying an awful lot to do this, and you have a responsibility to them. You know, I'm a self-taught writer. I mean, I learned how to write by writing and by reading, and I never took any writing courses, and they're all taking advanced writing courses and are going to get MFAs, and I was just able to scratch out a BA, and it wasn't in creative writing that I don't even think there was any such a degree being awarded at my school. So,
what was your BA in?
Just in literature, in English literature. And I got that because, you know, in my senior year, I just looked at my transcript and added up.
What could I get? What could I graduate in?
yeah. What did I do? What happened?
Right.
And I went to school not far from the University of Iowa, because I went to school at the University of Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the first time I taught at the University of Iowa, I was going through a divorce. I was starting a new relationship. I was separated from my children. So there were a lot of stresses on me. I also didn't have my dog.
Aww.
I mean, so there was an awful lot of stresses on me. And, you know, happily, the people in the program were really friendly, and Frank was very outgoing and welcoming, and I was teaching with you know, Dean Young and John Casey and Marilyn Robinson was there at the time, and so I was entertained enough to stave off a great loneliness. And also there were the Saturday softball games of the fiction writers versus the poets. I was sure, of course, that we would just trounce the poets.
Oh, of course.
But that didn't turn out to be true, and I had to counsel my team, my poor dejected, thoroughly beaten fiction writers. They said, "Hey, you guys, you have to write 25 pages a week. These poets, all they have to do is write a stanza, and so they have all this time to practice their softball skills. Of course, they're going to beat us." The second time that I came to Iowa City, I came with my partner, Joanne Beard, who had lived in Iowa City for many years and had many friends and close associates there. And so that was a much different experience. And this time, we brought the dogs, and it was... It was not the same experience of isolation. But, do I think that I gave my students their money's worth? I don't really know. I don't know exactly what students get out of creative writing. I mean, I can teach them editing skills. I can teach them patience. I can tell them stories about the publishing world, that will demystify it. But in terms of teaching somebody how to write, I'm not sure what I did there.
Now, the Iowa Writers' Workshop used to have a reputation for being kind of brutal in the workshopping process.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you?
I don't. I'm not like that.
That's. I'm
no,
glad.
I actually tried to do. I maybe went too far the other direction. Mm. That I would bring a great big salad bowl filled with candy that people could just munch on, and just to make it just we're here, we're friends, and I don't think that it's helpful in any way. There's no real educational value in humiliating somebody, or reducing somebody to tears, or telling somebody that there's no value in what they did, and I wouldn't permit it.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I agree with you. On the other hand, I've been in workshops, but not not at that level, but where nobody says anything at all critical. How are you going to learn anything?
Yeah, I know. It can turn into a puppy pile, and everybody,
Yeah. And sometimes it's like everybody will be so glowing about something that I'm like, seriously? And then harsh on somebody else that I think is more real. So,
No, that's interesting. So what do you do then? If you try to swing them over to reading it the way you did?
Yeah, it's been a while. I haven't done any workshops for a long time, but I think I probably usually just tried to balance out the opinions being given with mine. And it was more on the side there. I remember some that people were just like, oh, this is so wonderful. And for me, it was like, well, this is just stream of consciousness and doesn't really say anything. But I didn't say that. I wouldn't say that. Yeah.
I mean, and then you're left with a situation. You have 15 people in a room, and then nobody's saying what they want to say.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say, look at what. We've all read this. We all have our own thoughts about it. What can we do to make it better? What could improve this?
Yeah.
I mean, and I do believe this, that they would learn more during the workshop when it wasn't their own piece that was being discussed. they would learn more by looking at what someone else is doing and figuring out how it could be better.
That makes a lot of sense. And when you're studying writing, you tend to read everything with that critical eye of, you know, what works here, what doesn't work here, whereas normally as a reader you don't think about that. You
right.
might, when you're done with the book, think, well, that didn't quite work for me, but you're not like trying to analyze what works and what doesn't. And it can be interesting to read that way, but it's more fun to just read.
I know, but, you know, it's sort of like then that knowledge becomes the elephant in the room. It's hard to ignore
exactly
that you realize that this book didn't just fall out of the sky, that somebody wrote it and made choices and then
and
went
why
to
they
bed
did it
and
that
had
way
a cold.
And
yeah.
So, Scott, another thing I wanted to ask you about is you're in New York. How are things in New York now?
Well, I'm not in New York City.
Okay.
I'm 90 miles north of New York City. So things here were very frightening at first, you know, especially because, we have a close relationship with New York and even a closer one with Westchester. And there were people here who were sick. But almost all of our stores were closed, and nobody wanted to even go get food at the supermarket. But, it wasn't like being in the city because we have so much outdoor space here to walk around and never see another person. I mean, I live on a dirt road, and there's no neighbors nearby. So we didn't have that sense of being cooped up, but we did have the sense that the world as we had come to know it, and especially many of the things we love, like concerts and theater and bookshops, we might not ever see again, or that we were going to see it in some radically diminished way. Now, that seems like maybe we got more frightened than we needed to be, but I'm not sure where we are, because it's very hard to get any stable stream of information that you can trust. The White House has been completely discredited. You have somebody there who doesn't even understand what he's talking about half the time. So in terms of guidance, it's hard to know what to do in terms of being able to predict what's in store. That's also very difficult. I mean, right now, I find myself, sort of loosening my grip on the reins and going back to what is more normal in life. I'm playing tennis, I'm taking walks, sort of socially distanced walks with people, doing a tiny bit of visiting also outside. And,
yeah. And I think those things are probably fairly safe, but there's so many people who are doing things that really aren't, and the numbers keep going up, and they don't seem to care.
No, they don't. I mean, right now, like, walking around without a mask seems to be like wearing a Make America Great hat.
Yeah.
It just seems there's something sort of political and aggressive and defiant about it.
Yeah, and stupid, but
right.
Ignorant.
Well, today, maybe right now as we're speaking, people are filing into an auditorium in Tulsa, and there'll be 20,000 of them cheek to jowl.
I know.
And most of them won't be wearing a mask.
Yeah. Well, my son posted on Facebook a while back. He said, I'm going to miss wearing a mask. It's really easy to tell who the stupid people are so you can avoid them.
yeah. Well, I've got grandchildren who live not that far away, and they came running out toward me, and they were both wearing little masks. It sort of broke my heart.
Oh, I know. But as the saying goes, this too shall pass. We're not quite sure when and how, but...
Yeah, well, someone was telling me yesterday that this idea that, you know, pandemics come and go is true, but they don't come and go that quickly.
No. Yeah, that's for sure. So one last question. Do you do any other types of writing other than fiction?
I have. Right now, I don't. I've done a lot of journalism for Rolling Stone. I've written for the New Yorker, for the New York Times, and I've done a lot of travel writing for Travel and Leisure. But now I'm just concentrating on writing fiction.
And I'm guessing you've got another novel in the works.
I do. I have found it hard to write during the pandemic. Obviously, it's not because I don't have enough time, but there's been a kind of deterioration of attention that is getting in the way.
Well, plus you have to clean out the basement.
Oh.
Yeah. Before we started recording, Scott told me that he was glad to have this break because he had to clean out the basement, and this was a good excuse not to.
No. It's pretty Freudian cleaning out the basement, you know.
How long have you been in that house?
I've been in this house since the spring of 1983.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, wow. Yeah.
You can imagine.
Yes, I can imagine. Yeah. And is it anywhere near Orkney?
Well, it's near Orkney. It's, obviously all that stuff is imaginary. The town of Leyden is imaginary.
This is the setting. So, one of the settings in An Ocean Without a Shore is this old rundown derelict mansion called Orkney in New York.
Right. But when I imagined Orkney, I imagined it someplace not far from here, but not here.
Okay. Just across the river, maybe.
Well, my house doesn't overlook the river, and Orkney does.
Okay. Gotcha. Well,
it's
Scott...
a better house than mine.
Yeah, or at least a better setting, better view.
Right.
And, you know, you do pay for the view. So.
It's true.
Yeah. Well, Scott, we're out of time, and I just want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks, Monica. It was fun talking with you.
And we usually close with a quote from Caroline, from my mother, but since she's not here, I looked up one on unrequited love from Washington Irving. Love is never lost. If not reciprocated, it will flow back and soften and purify the heart.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Is that from, like, a letter?
I don't know. It just says, yeah. Washington Irving, so I'm not quite sure where.
Yeah, so. Washington Irving's popular around here because, you know, Rip Van Winkle's about the Hudson Valley.
Of course. That's right. Well, thanks for being with us. See you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.